she explores the big questions of life, and it's also very personal, so you can see yourself in the songs.
One of the greats, like Shakespeare, Robert Burns, Bob Dylan, John Lennon.
I've always been a creature of change. I have a pretty average North American attention span, I guess global attention span at this point. I crave change. As a result of that, I've been called the folk singer in the 60s, the confessional poet in the 70s, that jazz singer.
She was one of the most interesting people I've ever met. I've been around a while.
Every song she sang, I'm telling you, every song she sang wiped me out.
Woke up, it was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I saw was the sun, two yellow curtains, and a rainbow on the wall. The red, green, and gold to welcome you, crimson crystal beads to beckon.
She's one of the most accomplished guitarists of the last 60 years, and Rolling Stone magazine has called her one of the greatest songwriters ever. She's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and her music has been covered by the likes of Judy Collins, The Counting Crows, Cher, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. She is, of course, Joni Mitchell.
And the rainbow runs away. I will bring you incense owls by night, by candlelight, by jewel light, if only...
I'm Keris Matthews, and you're listening to Girl on Guitar here on BBC Radio 2.
Wake up, it's a Chelsea morning.
She plays guitar her own way. She writes songs her own way. She may look like a West Coast hippie, but this girl's got fight in her. She doesn't pull any punches. And she takes risks musically.
What always amuses me is that as soon as there's a new young female singer-songwriter out, any girl with a guitar, all the reviews can say is, it sounds like a young Joni Mitchell. And it's funny because I don't think there's anybody that sounds like a young Joni Mitchell. I don't think there ever will be.
Joni Mitchell is great as... Dylan or Byron or Shakespeare or Robert Burns. She's a creative, and she did with her creativity something that was highly unusual at the time, incredibly symbiotic as well. Like, as soon as she opened the gates, thousands flooded through.
Joni Mitchell is one of only two women to have made it onto Rolling Stone magazine's 100 Greatest Guitarists of All Time. She's also received 8 Grammys and a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder, caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful, the sky was full of thunder, and tearful at the falling of a star.
She's one of those artists that was always slightly ahead.
Arts journalist and cultural commentator Kate Mossman.
She came up through the folk scene and probably tired of it and moved on intellectually and wanted to go on to jazz and then on to African and world influences. I think if you can tell by the way the songs are constructed that the mind is so musical that it can't stand still for very long. Another example of a musician like that is Peter Gabriel or Paul Simon. They can't stick to one genre. Sometimes they're ahead of themselves and everyone thinks, what on earth are they doing with some sort of strange African flute in there? And then we look back years later and we think, oh, they were an innovator, you know.
But for me, it's the music of Joni Mitchell that remains timeless. And maybe this is because she writes lyrics that speak to the listener. She's eclectic, experimental, and prolific.
Okay, let's say, which came first, the lyric or the music? Usually the music comes first.
Joni's speaking to Jan Gomeshi in an interview for Canadian broadcaster CBC. This is the first time it's been broadcast here in the UK.
And then, you know, I mantra it, I play it over and over, and in that kind of trance-like, a lot of it's kind of soothing, even if it's rhythmic, you know, it's never... You know, I write some party songs, but mostly I write late at night and for myself, and so it can be grooving, but, you know, and I'm listening to those chords and I go, okay, you know, this is the here's where the pinnacle thought has to go, here's where the high note goes, and this is where the main thrust, the most important idea has to go, because this is the pinnacle in the music. So then I'll get the melody, then I'll go over it, like the Beatles, like scrambled eggs, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, maybe get something phonetic. And then something happens in the course of a day. Maybe it all comes in one day, or maybe it's later that week, right. Or in some cases, it's taken as long as 7 years to get the libretto, you know, to what is this music craving as a story. Yes. And then you try, I try, it's a point of craft with me, to marry so that that it's theatrical. First of all, they're dramatic pieces. It's frustrated filmmaking. It's very visual.
I don't think anyone would argue with the idea that she lyrically is up there with Bob Dylan. She has an incredible ability to compress thoughts into a couple of lines. One of my favourite lines of all is from Harry's House, where she talks about a helicopter landing like a dragonfly on a tomb. And it's almost this vividly impressionistic way of writing, which sometimes gets overlooked when people think of her as writing songs about human interactions and relationships. And I think it shouldn't be forgot that she's one of the poets of the 20th and 21st century, alongside Dylan and alongside Cohen and alongside people like Hart Crane and T.S. Eliot as well.
It's just kind of being lucky. You know, you have a song, for instance, Underneath the Streetlight was an assignment. I needed to write some brighter tempo pieces to complete this album. And I had gone to New York, and the moment I got there, I started painting, and everybody kept saying, when are you coming home? And I said, as soon as I'm finished, you know, and I kept waiting for this painting to end, and I would paint, and then to clear my mind, I have a pinball machine, so I would go over and play the pinball machine. The machine is situated next to a window in an 11-story building, and down below me is the street, so at night there are people going by. So I made this. I wore down the rug between where I paint and the pinball machine, night after night after night, no song, you know. And during that time, every time I looked out the window, something would be going by underneath the streetlight. So when finally the day came that I looked at the painting and said, that's it, I can't do it anymore, bam, the song came bursting out, and it contained mostly these images of the people passing underneath this light that I see.
Most of the subjects that she touched on, I thought, when she played, were personal experiences.
Musician Max Bennett has played on Joni's albums and toured with her.
That's one of the things that made her song so interesting, because the lyrics were all personally hers. You know, they weren't so universal, like if I wrote a song, it would be more universal. It's like when somebody invents something that's brand new and there wasn't any past to it, you know, in a sense.
Of course, it's for her guitar playing that many fans love her, and many of us fellow musicians look up to her.
Betsy's blue, she says, and tell me something good.
Almost every song Joni has written on the guitar uses non-standard tuning. This and her highly rhythmic strumming style creates a rich and unique guitar sound.
Sometimes the light can be so hard to find. At least the moon at the window, the thieves left that behind.
She would very often have extraordinary chords tuned and find inversions within them that sounded very unusual.
Music and record producer Thomas Dolby.
This is in stark contrast to contemporaries of hers, like, let's say, Bob Dylan or Paul Simon. So I think her guitar playing was always very unusual. Most of her songs, I think, she wrote either on piano or guitar and then added overdubs of different patterns, different parts. And just really unique textures.
You can't exactly pin it down. You don't know what she's doing, but you know it sounds different. And she's a very accomplished guitar player, but she's used the guitar as a sort of a momentum behind the lyrics rather than a standout sort of showy moment. She's not doing Van Halen-style solos on stage.
First of all, she had a really good time when she played the guitar. And the way she voiced her chords, because she changed the different... changed her keys on the guitar a lot, was so unique. No one has ever done that before that I know of. As a matter of fact, I asked Robin Ford, who was our guitar player at the time, what was she doing? And he said he had no idea. of what she was doing. But she would, you know, turn one up and turn another one down of the strings and get a different sound on the guitar.
Originally, Joni tried to teach herself how to play from a Pete Seeger songbook. She never finished the book, though. Her left hand had been weakened by childhood polio, and some of the fingerings were difficult. Never one to give up, Joni created alternative tunings that allowed her to play her music her way. Singer and songwriter Eddie Reader.
She's an amazing guitar player because she shows you how to use the guitar in a way that introduces more than just the technical academic quality of the guitar. It uses it as it is, raw, if you like, by tuning the strings to what you want. You can make an absolute orchestra happen.
Of course, a lot of guitarists, from Jimmy Page to Davy Graham, have done this, but this is something that she did in her own unique way.
Singer and songwriter Jennifer Crook.
What it means is that you have an open tuning, which makes the chords much more interesting, and therefore the songs and the colour of the harmony and everything with it. So instead of being in standard tuning, which E, A, D, G, B, E, she tuned up to an open D. So take your E down to D. A stays the same, D stays the same, and then your G, you're going down to an F sharp, B goes down to an A, quite a long way down that one. And the E down to D. So the strings are a lot looser, obviously, because they've been lowered.
I remember when she asked us to do a couple of songs on an album.
Max Bennett again.
We got into the studio, and she started playing, and Joe Sample and I looked at each other and went, I don't know, this is so different. It was like nothing we'd ever heard, in a way. The construction of the music itself, never mind the lyrics, which were great, but we're concerned more with the music. And it was very elusive, in a sense, harmonically.
But how did this guitar great get into music in the first place? Joni Anderson was born on November the 7th, 1943, in Fort McLeod, Canada. Her father was an amateur musician who loved swing music and played the trumpet in a marching band.
I can remember, I have a very early memory of being walked on a leash, and I had on a little white kind of snowsuit, and we passed a Woolworths, and the Woolworths had a wedge-shaped opening to it, and in the roof of the exterior of the building was a kind of a speaker, a tin speaker, and there was some kind of music, I don't know what it would be, spilling out there. And I stopped on my leash and began to bounce up and down and sing with great enthusiasm. My mother gave me a good tug. So, you know, at an early age, you know, music was a great pocket to be in.
Many of Joni's childhood friends were taking music lessons, and so she tagged along with them. She'd also developed a love for the likes of Chopin, Beethoven, and Rachmaninoff. But when did the listener become the musician? It was while she was recovering in hospital from polio that Joni first began performing by singing to the other patients. Her first musical love was rock and roll, but when she was a teenager, that sort of music was rarely on the radio. So if you didn't have a record player, you went to where there was a jukebox.
Mm-hmm.
sure do. And Chuck Berry were like the call of the wild, you know, like the radio was for many years, as a child, was full of ballads and classical programming and Mantovani, and it was fairly bland, although there was a lot of melody on the radio in those days. And then came rock and roll. When rock and roll came roaring onto the scene with all the controversy that it included, you know, it was mostly black and it was raw and raging. Lucille would be a good example of that, or Ray Charles, you know, Johnny B. Goode. And it was great. I mean, it stirred up your feet, it stirred up your whole body. Next thing you knew, like, you wanted to go to 3 or 4 dances a week and nothing else was so important.
By 1957, the girl on the guitar had bought herself a ukulele. She had wanted a guitar, of course, but her mother was against the idea because of the guitar's supposed hillbilly image. Joni got her way in the end, though, and when she finished high school, playing music was a way to make some extra money. But she never expected to make a career out of it.
After a few years, the music scene shifted, and with the coming of a lot of white rock and roll, some of it was excellent, And some of it got very formulated, and the spirit got more, I guess, middle class or more genteel. It made it palatable. It gave rock and roll became respectable in a certain way, and it made for a very kind of dull pocket of music. And during that bland kind of period, my interests began to search through other styles of music, and then with the Beatles opening up the music again, lyrics began to become important. And jazz and folk music providing a kind of an introspective vacation, so to say, from rock and roll in the middle. Then along came Dylan, and he kind of put the two things together.
Her first love was painting, and so she enrolled at the Alberta College of Art and Design. Joni needed to support herself through school, though, and so she kept gigging as a folk musician. After a year, she dropped out of school and kept playing.
There's a crow flying, talking ragged, tree to tree. He's black as the highway that's leading me. Now he's diving down to pick up on.
Joni was developing an interest in jazz and became a regular audience member at jazz gigs.
She moved, I think, towards them, rather than moved out from them.
Folk singer and writer Judy Collins.
And the more she was experimenting with tuning, I think that had a lot to do with it, and rhythm, and being able to work with synthesizers. And, you know, sometimes I'd call her in the middle of the night and she'd say, I'm in the middle of this thing, I'm going to be up all night with it. She really began to experiment a lot, and it drew her to a lot of jazz musicians. And then, of course, she moved into that direction with her albums. But I would say for Joni that she was more influencing than influenced by. I think her music influenced young writers a lot.
Well, I think any creative is going to be what you would call a jazz artist. What I understand as being a jazz artist is somebody who takes a form and improvises. And everyone I know, folk musicians, pop musicians, rock musicians, Jimi Hendrix solos, that is all jazz. That is all about improvisation. So your improvisation starts in a freeform way, and then you try and capture it, and then you have to, and then you have the melody line, then you have the arrangement. But it all starts with improvisation, so it's all jazz to me. And I think she's one of the top jazz performers I've ever heard, and I've heard a few.
In the summer of 1964, Joni headed east to Ontario to take her chances as a folk singer. On the 3-day train ride there, she wrote her first song, Day After Day.
Day after day, miles and miles of railroad track.
She also stopped off at the Mariposa Folk Festival to see Buffy Sainte-Marie, a Saskatchewan-born folk singer who'd inspired her. A year later, Joni would be playing Mariposa herself.
Their humming seems to say, he'll follow you someday.
In late 64, Joni discovered that she was pregnant by her ex-boyfriend. Unable to provide for the baby, Joni gave her up for adoption and kept the child a secret for most of her career.
The thing that keeps getting written is that I gave up my daughter in order to further my career. This is just not so.
Joni speaking to CBC's Jan Gomeshi.
What was done at that time was you didn't even see the daughter. You didn't have the right thing to do to protect your parents was to get out of town, go into a home. Well, in 65, the homes were full. So many girls got cut out because everything was changing and the pill was not available. So there were a lot of unwed children born in 1965, more than could be adopted, and all the homes were full. So it was very difficult to survive. I mean, at the time I had her, I was destitute. And there was no way I could take her out of the hospital into a blizzard with no job, no roof over my head. There was no way I could take her. And there weren't even foster homes available at that time because there was such a glut of unwed children. But she was beautiful, and she found her way into a foster home. And I tried to get work and get a setup that I could bring her to. Well, in that time period, I couldn't get any work in Toronto because I couldn't get $160 to get into the union. I was beset by predators, you know, like people trying to take advantage of the situation. I won't name names, but a lot of human ugliness came at me because I was in a white slavers. I mean, you wouldn't believe the gauntlet you have to run when you're young, destitute. You know, it was a very difficult situation.
Hints about the child did appear in several songs, though, particularly Little Green. Joni and her daughter finally met in 1997.
Born with the moon in Cancer, choose her a name she will answer to. Call her Green, and the winters cannot fade her.
Green to me was, you know, speaking to me as a green young girl listening to her for the first time.
Eddie Reader.
When it really got me was when I put it on a compilation tape and I was having a party, and there was a woman friend of mine whose husband had left her, and she brought up the two kids mostly on her own. And when I played it, she just started weeping for her own young children and how they'd grown up. And it was obviously a song, she was about 10 years older than me, and it was obviously a song that she had got into when she was my age, when I first got into it, you know, when I was 18. So it reminded her of herself too, and that's when I really realised the power of that song.
Icicles and birthday clothes, and sometimes there'll be so.
A few weeks after the birth, Joni was gigging again, and she soon found work in a folk club in Toronto, where she met American singer Chuck Mitchell. Joni and Chuck headed south to the USA, where they married, and Joni Anderson became Joni Mitchell. The marriage was over in less than 2 years, though, and Joni moved to New York. She played venues up and down the East Coast and became well known for her unique songwriting and guitar styles. Judy Collins.
I'm touched by her songs because they're vivid, they're incredibly musical, they're revealing, they're very she's a very vulnerable writer. She talks about things that people can identify easily.
Well, I think lyrically, the kind of subjects she tries to tackle, just embracing ambiguity, that's something I try to work with my songs.
Jennifer Crook.
I mean, just listening to her songs, I mean, it stretches you, because she was stretching how we use language and the music as well. I think later people came to appreciate her musical skills as well as her lyrical skills.
Fly, silly seabird, no dreams can possess you. No voices can blame you for sun on your wings.
When David Crosby of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young heard Joni sing, he was immediately sold on her talent. He persuaded a record company to let her make an acoustic album without the folk rock overdubs that were common at the time. Song to a Seagull was the result. By 1969, Joni was already on her second album, and it included her own versions of songs which had already been recorded by other artists, incredible songs like Chelsea Morning and Both Sides Now, which was first released by the legendary folk singer Judy Collins.
It was probably June of 1967, and I got a call from my friend Al Cooper, who started the Blood, Sweat and Tears, and he called me up. We were very good friends. And so about 3 in the morning, the phone rang, and it was Al, and he said, you know, I followed this girl home because she's been hanging out at the bar here. And he said, she told me she wrote songs, and she was very good looking, so I decided I couldn't lose. So I followed her home so she could play me a song. And he said, you got to hear this. And he put her on the phone, and she sang Both Sides Now. So I said, I'll be right over. I recorded Both Sides Now within the month, I think.
Goes and flows of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feathered canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way.
So it became a huge hit for me, and of course it made Joni Mitchell's name and made everybody know who she was. It's a sudden kind of over-the-moon presence in the world, and it was her moment to kind of come out and have everybody know about it.
Looked at life from both sides now, then win and lose, and still somehow it's life's illusions. I recall, I really don't know life at all.
She was not an older woman when she wrote Both Sides Now.
Arts journalist and cultural commentator Kate Mossman.
But I think no song better sums up Joni Mitchell's handling of the feeling of disappointment and resignation than Both Sides Now. She is absolutely brilliant at calmly standing back from a situation and somehow rising above it.
Joni's version of Both Sides Now came from the 1969 album Clouds, which won Joni her first Grammy Award. The album cover was a self-portrait, a mixing of Joni's art and music, which would continue throughout her career. TV and radio producer Trevor Dann.
Back in the 1980s, when I was working for the Old Grey Whistle Test, we were invited to make a film with Joni to publicise what was then her most recent album. And we said, do you know, it would be great to just do an interview, that's fine, but could we go to her house? Because we're really interested in the fact that she makes these big oil paintings. And they came back and they said, yes, you can, which we were really surprised about. And we turned up, she was just fantastic. Come in, have a cup of tea, come and have a look at my paintings.
In solitude, what it does is it clears the head. You know, it's kind of like summer following for me. If it would burn out. My talent would have burned out long ago, I think, as a writer or a musician, if it wasn't for the painting. Because it's mindless in a way. I mean, your critic, your analytical judgment has to come in at a certain part, but certainly not at this part of the process. This is just child's play, you know?
At that point, she was doing really abstract kind of Jackson Pollock stuff on massive canvases. They must have been these canvases about, you know, 10 feet by 6 feet. And the way she painted them was by getting great big blobs of paint from the can and simply throwing them at the canvas.
You have to imagine that this is like little snails crawling over leaves now with sticky substances coming out of their mouth. I mean, just this is chaos. All this is a lot of things coming at each other.
And you could see there that that was an artist at work, and that's how she often made her music. She defied the convention. Everybody expected her to play the guitar, so she played the piano. Everybody expected her to be a folky singer-songwriter, so she got into jazz. Everyone expected her to do jazz, so she went and did something else. You know, that was always her thing. She was challenging the audience and herself.
Her third LP, 1970's Ladies of the Canyon, saw Joni moving towards a pop and rock style. It was her first gold album and included the hits The Circle Game and the iconic Big Yellow Taxi. I'm Keris Matthews and you're listening to Girl on Guitar here on BBC Radio 2.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Big Yellow Taxi is the one that people who don't know anything about Joni Mitchell think about when they think of Joni, particularly the laugh at the end and the line about the tree museum.
Journalist and broadcaster Kate Mossman.
I think it's a beautifully energetic, romantic, young Joni record. But again, to me, all the energy in that song is the idea of the relationship finishing. Big Yellow Taxi took away my old man. She's not gutted.
Yeah, I learned that on guitar, Big Yellow Taxi. That was my party piece for ages.
Fairground Attractions, Eddie Reader.
The beauty of it is the kind of almost protestiness of it, but also the rhythm of it is what I got off on. I love the bar chords and the E chord, or the E. It was either in an E tuning or a D tuning, and it was very rhythmic. It was bar da jank bar ba ba jank jank bar ba jank bam bam ba jigga daga doga. So I learned how to play guitar a lot on that tune.
They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
After Ladies of the Canyon, Joni stopped touring for a year so she could concentrate on songwriting and painting. It didn't stop her being voted the top female performer of 1970 by the Melody Maker, though.
Like, I used to put out an album a year in the first part, but then the press got longer, the tours got longer, the illnesses increased, and they're going, well, you're not putting out as much as you used to, you know? And you go, geez, I'm dancing as fast as I can, you know? And I'm not going to tell them, well, I just spent a year in bed, it's none of your business.
The song she wrote during that time off appeared on her next album, Blue.
A lot of people are listening to me. Well, then they better find out who they're worshipping. Let's see if they can take it, let's get real. So I wrote Blue, which horrified a lot of people. And then it created a lot of attention that was really weird. And so then I bought a property in British Columbia and dropped out. Because what had happened is they're looking at me, and all I've done is reveal human traits. They haven't seen themselves in it. At the point that they see themselves in it, the communication is complete.
Blue made the top 20 in the American Billboard charts and reached number 3 here in the UK. From that album, this is Kerry.
The wind is in from Africa. Last night I couldn't sleep. Oh, you know it sure is hard to leave here, Kerry, but it's really not my home. My fingernails are filthy. I've got beach tar on my feet. And I miss my clean white linen. My fancy French cologne. Oh, Kerry, get out your cane.
Kerry, for me, contains all the feeling of urgency that Joni Mitchell always has about moving on to the next place. So the wind's in from Africa. She has beach tar on her feet.
Kate Mossman.
And she says to Kerry, you know, I love it here, but it's not my home. And you think, she's really not that sad to leave. She's already made her mind up days ago, and this is just her farewell.
She had attracted some attention before. She'd had some minor hits with things like From Both Sides Now.
Producer and musician Thomas Dolby.
But Blue was the album that critically got her in everybody's face. It was really an anthemic album of the time. Songs in there about living in a cave in Greece and dancing barefoot on the table at the Mermaid Cafe.
The imagery is just so visual.
Jennifer Crook.
You can see it. It's the line, "My fingernails are filthy, I've got beach tar on my feet, and I miss my clean white linen and my fancy French cologne." It's a brilliant line.
Joni soon returned to life performing, and her fifth album, For the Roses, came out in late 72. It included You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio.
Driving into town with the dark cloud above you, dialing the number who's bound to love you. Oh, honey, you turn me on, I'm a radio, I'm a country station, I'm a little bit corny.
Was that not her attempt at a pop song, right?
Fairground Attractions, Eddie Reader.
Because they'd sort of challenged, or she felt challenged, and there she is, she did it. It's just great, it's just a pop song. And I think she treated it as such, and it's a great thing to listen to. There's nothing I could say is more satisfying than that song. I think she plays it on dulcimer too, so she uses the four-string dulcimer to play the riff of it.
Joni's next album, Court and Spark, saw her moving into jazz and jazz fusion. It went down well with the critics and became her most commercially successful project. It included the hits Help Me and Free Man in Paris.
The way I see it, he said, you just can't win it. Everybody's in it for their own gain, you can't please them all.
I started a band called LA Express. We were working at the Baked Potato in a valley in L.A.
Musician Max Bennett.
One night, Joni came in and was very impressed with the band. So she asked us if she loved the band. She wanted to know if we'd like to do a couple of songs on her next album that she did. And we said, sure. Fine. We were recording musicians. We were happy to record with anyone. So we got into the studio at A&M, and she started playing one of the songs, which happened to be Help Me. And I'm looking at Joe's sample, and he's looking at me, and we're thinking, I don't know if this is going to work or not, you know. But it's so unique, the way where she was coming from musically. Not only did we do tunes, we did the whole album, Court and Spark, and from that on, it was pretty much a love fest musically, I think.
What I love about Free Man in Paris as well is it shows her grasp of vocabulary.
Writer and broadcaster Trevor Dann.
Who else but Joni Mitchell would write the line, "As a free man in Paris, I felt unfettered and alive." Unfettered and alive. You know, people don't write those kind of lyrics. That's not an Elton John and Bernie Taupin lyric. That's not a Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber lyric. That's a Joni Mitchell lyric. Brilliant.
And as ever, with the release of an album, a tour date was soon to follow. And Max Bennett was on that tour.
Court and Spark had preceded her, not very long, just enough to really wake people up. And the crowds were so responsive that usually, you know, crowds can be very boisterous and noisy. I used to walk back at the back of the places where we were staying, where there would be like 18,000 people. When she was on, did her acoustic set, it would be completely, totally quiet. Everyone was listening to every note and every word she said.
Joni was back in the studio by the spring of 75. The album, The Hissing of Summer Lawns, was the result. Joni's musical influences were clearly moving towards jazz-inspired pieces, which made use of a wider range of instruments. And on the track The Jungle Line, she even sampled a recording of African musicians, something that wouldn't become commonplace until the 1980s. It's been said that Rolling Stone magazine declared it the worst album of the year. The truth, though, is a little different. They just said that it had the year's worst album title.
He bought her a diamond for her throat. He put her in a ranch house on the hills.
barbecues from a windowsill.
In the period of Hissing Summer Lawns, people didn't quite know what to make of what she was playing.
Kate Mossman.
And I think you find this often when someone has moved ahead quite fast and started bringing in synthesizers or jazz or instruments that aren't typically in the cool rock canon. It's not just electric guitars and drums and a plaintive voice. And I think that maybe the image that we have of Joni Mitchell is to a certain extent fixed by the reviews of Blue and Ladies of the Canyon. And it was a different woman, it was a different lifetime. But I think that, you know, I don't think there's any doubt in the minds of most of the arts press that Hegira and Hissing Summer Lawns and Court and Spark are brilliant records. But I guess that in terms of can you file them next to the Velvet Underground? No, you can't. You can't. They're not rock records.
In early 1976, Joni travelled with friends to Maine. Afterwards, she drove back to California alone and composed some of the songs that would feature on her next album, Hegira. Hegira has been described as one of Joni's more experimental albums, probably because of her collaboration with legendary jazz virtuoso Jaco Pastorius.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be bursting out a broodmare's tail.
Hegira is Joni Mitchell's masterpiece.
Trevor Dan.
It starts with the fantastic Coyote, which is, it's a great rock song, actually. I mean, everybody forgets that Joni Mitchell wrote This Flight Tonight, which was a great, you know, rock hit by Nazareth. You could make Coyote into a song by Iron Maiden if you wanted to. I mean, it rocks. And it's the musical setting that carries it. You can hear Jaco Pastorius playing the bass guitar, interpreting those lyrics, and he's not quite sure where to go, and then as she reaches the end of the phrase, it resolves. It's the most brilliant piece of jazz playing that is not just accompanying, but is supporting and driving the lyrical content, and that's where I think she found inspiration in jazz.
I think it's captivating because it's an electroacoustic album. It's got a very, very tight musical landscape to it, which is sustained throughout the whole record. A lot of turbulent kind of water wheel guitar playing, lovely jazz bass from Jaco Pastorius in a lot of the songs. And the record does actually feel like a road trip. It's Hegira means journey, and it really has that sense of movement and energy behind it, which I think a lot of that comes from this electroacoustic jazz work that you can hear there. That's not a folk record. And whenever people call her a folk musician, I think, well, you turned off the radio about 1965 then, if you did that.
Well, by the time she is recording Hegira, one of the things she's doing is double-tracking a lot of the guitar parts to make it as huge a sound as possible.
Jennifer Crook.
And I think there's an even later album where her credit is guitar orchestra. So she really, really takes what perhaps began as making it more open, brighter, with the tunings, and then kind of builds on that.
A few months after the release of her next album, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, Joni was contacted by the jazz great Charles Mingus. They started to work together, but he died before the project could be completed. Joni finished it, though, and the album, Mingus, was released in 1979.
Well, he called for me. You know, he called out to me to do a project with him. And as soon as I saw him, there was a look on his face, which I tried to paint on the Mingus cover, that wry look over his shoulder, you know, like just up to no good, you know, just delicious mischief. As soon as I saw that look on his face, I thought, oh, well, this will be fun, you know. He had a great spirit, and it was an opportunity to apprentice under a great master. I know friends of mine who were jazz musicians. I wasn't a jazz musician, but a folk singer that played with jazz musicians, you might say, or God knows what. So the idea of working with him made me a source of envy to many of my friends. And one by one, I brought a lot of those people into play on the record. It wasn't the way it finally came out, but there were a lot of people kind of lined up, honored to be working on his last project.
I think it's really interesting that people like Charlie Mingus and Benny Goodman actually get name checks in Joni Mitchell's later songs. You can tell that as a singer-songwriter, she was not prepared to be constrained by folk music. She wasn't going to just sit there with a guitar and play the same three or four chords. She was interested in painting her lyrical pictures using lots of different palettes. And just as she used oil paints and watercolours in music, she would use jazz and classical influences and folk influences. She was never happy with one idea. She was a restless artist, and I think has remained so.
I have sympathy with the fans. I understand that there's some... The fact that I'm interested in certain color schemes, you know, doesn't mean that everybody's going to be interested in the same color schemes. Muted chords, you know, dusty colors. I got sick of the downbeat, and I took it to the limit where the backbeat, you can't lose it. I lost it. A lot of the Mingus stuff, I had the rhythm just flowing all over freely, you know.
And saxophone, Michael Brecker.
After touring the album, Joni turned recordings of the Los Angeles shows into a live album and a concert film, Shadows and Light.
And Gums and Kungas, Don Elias.
For the next 18 months, Joni worked on her next album, Fast.
One shadow cursed and another shadow laughing underneath the streetlight. I don't know where they're coming from, I just see them. Underneath the street light.
Yes, I do, I love ya.
Yes, I do, I love ya. Underneath the street light, for sure. That is really fun to sing.
In 1983, Joni set off on a world tour visiting Japan, Australia, Ireland, mainland Europe, and of course the UK. By the end of the following year, she was writing again, and synth-pop performer and producer Thomas Dolby was brought on board.
I first met Joni Mitchell in the autumn of 1984. She had heard a cover version that I'd done of her song, The Jungle Line, and she said, that's the sound that I want on my next album. So I spent much of the summer of 1985 in Los Angeles working with Joni and her then-husband, Larry Klein. I have to say that Joni Mitchell is somebody that can't really be produced. I mean, she has her own set of opinions about things, and you pretty much have to let her go at it. It was a mixed experience really for me, but I think the result was quite interesting. It was the first time she'd really used extensive electronics on one of her albums, and it was an interesting experiment and departure for her.
The album they produced was Dog Eat Dog, and it dealt with some of the big issues of the 1980s, such as consumerism and famine in Ethiopia.
It got criticism from many places because people felt that it was too electronic sounding compared to the organic sound that Joni had in the past with her guitar-based and piano-based material. But I think it was a breakthrough for her nonetheless, and I think between her and Larry Klein, they managed on that album to embrace new technologies such as samplers and computers and so on, and weave them into the sound, which in future albums gave her the ability to stretch out.
One of the songs on Dog Eat Dog, Tax Free, focused on televangelists and what Joni saw as a drift to the religious right in American politics.
During the Ronald Reagan era, which coincided with the expansion of cable TV in the USA, you could channel surf and you could find hundreds, literally hundreds of channels of TV evangelists spouting their stuff in the USA. It was extremely right-wing, and usually there was an 800 number at the bottom asking you to pledge money so that they could afford their private jet for their next tour. And Joni would watch these in amazement, and it kind of matched a certain anger and fury that she was beginning to feel about the way the USA was going. And so it made a lot of sense for her to write this song, Tax Free, which she originally... We used samples from TV evangelists, but because of copyright issues and the risk of being sued, she eventually got Rod Steiger, the actor, to replace some of those parts and play the part of the evangelist.
Hundreds of millions of dollars. Tax free. 100 million dollars.
Joni continued experimenting with synthesizers, sequencers, and drum machines for her next album, 1988's Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm. By 1990, she was working on her next album, Night Ride Home. It signalled a move closer to her acoustic beginnings, along with some elements in the style of Hejira. To wider audiences, Joni's real return to form came with a Grammy Award-winning Turbulent Indigo. Songs such as Sex Kills, Sunny Sunday and The Magdalene Laundries mixed social commentary and guitar-focused melodies for a startling comeback.
I was an unmarried girl, I just turned 27, when they sent me to the sisters for the way men looked at me.
Two years later, Joni released her final original work, Taming the Tiger, before nearly a decade of other pursuits. It was around this time that critics began to comment on the change in Joni's voice.
It changes, you know, your phrasing changes, you know, just maturing, you know, chronologically changes voices. Although when I sing in a certain range, I still sound like I'm about 17 and I'm on helium.
Her more limited range and huskier vocals were put down to smoking, but Joni believes that the changes were due to other problems, including vocal nodules, a compressed larynx, and the lasting effects of polio.
A lot of people don't realize that what a strain it is on the vocal cords to sing.
Musician Max Bennett played on several of Joni's albums.
When you think about somebody standing all night in front of an audience and singing their heart out, that's hard work. And the vocal cords, through many, many years, suffer from that a bit, as far as range in particular.
Back on the very early records, it's almost like a Disney high voice, a lovely sort of tweeting bird sound.
Kate Mossman.
And then when she did Both Sides Now in 2000, which was the orchestral reimaginings, it was almost part of the artistic experiment. Listen, this is what I sound like. And the songs were extremely somber, very, very dark. And for instance, the way she reimagined Case of You turned it from this kind of luscious moment when you realise you're in a bar falling in love with somebody to someone looking on in their 60s thinking possibly I lost that person, or that was a feeling I haven't had for a long time. So she was experimenting with how deep her voice was.
Just before our love got lost, you said I am as constant as a northern star, and I said constantly in the darkness. Where's that hand? If you want me, I'll be in the bar.
In 2007, she was back. According to Joni, the album Shine was inspired by the war in Iraq, and something her grandson had said while listening to family members arguing. Bad dreams are good in the great plan. Nowadays, Joni's public appearances have become more infrequent. She's currently receiving treatment for Morgellon syndrome, a condition which results in crawling and stinging sensations under the skin. Joni speaking to Jan Gomeshi for a CBC interview never heard before in the UK.
This disease that I have is a nightmare. If you look at it subjectively, people all over the world kill themselves. They just can't take it. If you look at it objectively, it's fascinating.
Opinion in the medical community is split over whether Morgellons is an infection or a psychiatric disorder. Whatever the case, the symptoms are real, and Joni now works towards giving more credibility to people diagnosed with the ailment. But if and when she next steps onto the public stage, plenty of us will be hanging on Joni Mitchell's every word.
If I had to sum up Joni, I would say, first of all, a really good person, a really good gal, highly intelligent, unique, always thinking ahead. She could drive you crazy because she had so many thoughts all the time progressing in her head, and it was hard to keep up with her in a sense because that's just the way she thought.
You know, you can't have talent without having the guts to do it, and Joni has guts, and she's got tenacity, and she's hung in there no matter what. And she's risen from an unknown gal playing the ukulele to somebody who's written things that have been recorded by people all over the world in all kinds of languages. And she's unique. There's nobody who writes songs like that, I don't think.
Well, I couldn't agree more with those comments, but let's leave the last word to Joni herself.
If you elevate me, you're not going to meet yourself in my songs. You know, maybe you can do, I don't know, I don't think so. Yeah.
And I get the urge for going when the meadow grass is turning brown and summertime is falling down.
You've been listening to Girl on Guitar. It was presented by me, Keris Matthews, and it was written and produced by Phil Collinge. It was a Made in Manchester production for BBC Radio 2. Online, on digital radio, and on 88 to 91 FM, this is Radio 2 from the BBC.